Money Talks. My name is Mike Campbell. I'm glad you're with us this week. And by the way, let me just quickly respond to this, that I'm just so pleased and proud of the number of Money Talks listeners who joined us by donating to the Polar Plunge. I can't thank you enough. I can't tell you, words fail me, how much that meant to me and meant to Ozzy and meant to former Premier Gordon Campbell. The support was actually fantastic. And by the way, the weather gods were smiling on us because we got the best half an hour of the weekend. It was still only 4 degrees. The water was still right around the 10-year low. But man, that made a difference. But what really makes a difference is how many people stepped up and said, you know what? These people matter. These families matter to me. And I'm going to make a donation. So please accept my very, very deep and sincere thanks. But I'm glad you're here also because we have a terrific show planned for you. I've got Terry Glavin on with me. Come on, there is so much happening on two. I mean, Terry's a phenomenal expert in a number of areas, but so much happening on the China file, including, come on, we now have it verified that we had Chinese spies at our top virology lab. It's in Winnipeg. The government sat on the CSIS report for 4 years. They tried to shut down any inquiry, well, they successfully shut down any thoughts of actually getting an inquiry into why you hid that document for 4 years. So that's part of it on the plate. I want to talk to him about the rise in anti-Semitism in this country because Terry's done the best work on that, about specifically when, for example, the BC cabinet got rid of Selena Robinson, the only Jewish cabinet member. There's a lot behind it that didn't, certainly the mainstream media didn't uncover. Well, Terry did. As I say, I can go on because there's a lot more to do. He'll be with me in just a couple of minutes. Of course, I've got Victor and I've got Ozzy and I've got Neil McIver talking about a couple of things on your portfolio that you absolutely must be aware of. It's really interesting how a fad 1 year sort of gets out of fashion just a, well, 1-2 years later. He'll talk specifically about ESG in that regard. But first, it was one of those questions that I got that begged for a superficial answer. I mean, what would I do to improve government services? I suspect that the expected response was supposed to be something along the line of, well, we do more. We need government involved in X, Y, and Z, something like that. That would certainly be the go-to answer for millions of Canadians who want to see more and bigger government in more areas and are unbothered by the litany of stories of mismanagement, outright waste, poor, at times horrendous results. I mean, I'm blown away by that. You want the people who did a arrive can to manage something else? They don't seem to be bothered when you see things like the disastrous Phoenix Pay System, which former Auditor General Michael Ferguson called incomprehensibly incompetent. Millions of Canadians don't seem to be bothered by the failed multi-billion dollar gun registry, for example. Not bothered by the countless reports from the Auditor General, Parliamentary Budget Office on the tens of billions of dollars spent without measurable goals. Sometimes it's actually missing. Or the $60 billion that we've spent on climate initiatives, and we didn't do a single bit of cost-benefit analysis. And come on, they're not bothered that we can't find a family doctor, maybe get a passport in a timely manner, or the lack of affordable housing and rentals. That's a direct result of government policy. But somehow, we've got millions of Canadians saying, hey, let's do more of that. Let's get the government even more areas of our life, more intervention. I can only guess, because that's certainly not my opinion, but I can only guess that that's a result of a deep-seated ideology, because it sure isn't due to government performance in so many areas. But then again, I kind of think that's one of the major philosophical divides we have when it comes to government. For example, personally, I think that policy should be research-based and founded in fact, while others clearly think that policy should be ideologically driven. So, not surprisingly, by the way, measures of success also differ widely depending on one's starting point, one point of view. I mean, adhering to the ideology for some is the measure of success, which may explain why climate activists, for example, didn't have much of a reaction to the Environment Commissioner, Jerry DeMarco's report that found Canada was dead last in the G7 in terms of emission reductions, while others, like myself, have a different reaction. I mean, success is measured against specific, quantifiable goals. So when I see that Canada, despite spending tens of billions of dollars or forgoing revenue, had zero reductions, well, I think that's a failure. So not a surprise that my answer to how I would improve government services is more accountability, And when I read the conclusion of former Auditor General Michael Ferguson, he said that there's a culture in the federal civil service that's predicated by avoiding responsibility. Similar findings by the PBO and the Auditor General today. I think that's a huge problem. But again, that's because I evaluate success by quantifiable results against stated goals. Avoiding responsibility is not how that's going to happen. I should also throw in that I care about how my tax dollars are spent, and saying the right thing is not how I measure how effectively my money is spent. I want measurable results, which is why I'm shocked that last year, more than $190 million of taxpayer money funded bonuses to federal executives and upper management. I mean, I keep saying, for what? For the vast majority of time, though, I'm on the losing end of this debate. For the most part, government work or hard work avoids taking responsibility. Come on, just witness that 149 Liberal MPs who voted against having a special audit into the ArriveCam app. And you'll hear in a few minutes with Terry Glavin, you got the CSIS report into Chinese spying that was shelved for about 4 years, you know, spying at the top security virology lab. And they basically found that basic protocols about computer security were routinely ignored, but somehow no one's held accountable. As for ArriveCam, I'm still blown away by the fact that how did one single two-person company, GC Strategy, get, what was it, 19.1 million of work for that alone, just that one project. And all they did was hand it over to other suppliers, and they took a 30% commission, literally $5.7 million for doing nothing. But yet, when they asked Public Works Minister Jean-Yves Duclos who made that decision, they asked him 32 times. He never answered. Another example this past week, though, we had the Liberal, the New Democrat MPs blocking an ethics committee probe into why Cabinet concealed that Chinese security report for 4 years. But here's my big question. When does this end? When will the majority of Canadians, not the minority, but the majority of Canadians, focus on results instead of big talk? Is there any amount of money that you could waste in our tax dollars that would push the majority of us to demand a change in how government operates, including the lack of cost-benefit analysis or the failure to set measurable goals, and especially institute consequences when they're not achieved? Because you know why? We're clearly not there yet. Hey, I want to just remind you, you can go to mikesmoneytalks.ca. You can go to Money Talks, you know, because I say this because I appreciate when people do it. And they tell people to go to Money Talks tweets on Twitter, or X as it's called now. Go to Michael Campbell's Money Talks on Facebook. And again, so much more coming your way. So stay tuned right now. Turn up the volume. Terry Glavin, you can watch him with us on YouTube, or you can listen right here on the podcast. Do both, because I think it's worth hearing. You know, one of the things that we read about and hear polling results on is about the media and people's distrust of the media. In fact, there was one in-house survey done by the federal government that found that basically only about 30%, 33% of Canadians trust the media. And I want to be careful myself about broad generalizations, because then I remember the work of people like Terry Glavin, who've brought numerous stories to our attention, important stories that prove to be pivotal. And that's why I always want to remind people, there are some excellent people doing excellent work. That's why I'm pleased to bring one of them on with me right now, Terry Glavin, who's a leader in so many different areas, by the way, in subject areas. Today, I'm going to talk a little bit about the Winnipeg lab spying episode. Also, I'm going to get on to what's happened with Canada, anti-Semitism, that kind of thing. But Terry, first of all, thanks so much for taking the time.
Well, it's always nice to talk to you, Michael. It's always nice to talk.
Well, let's start with the Winnipeg lab situation. Maybe you could give people that in a nutshell. I mean, I'm, you know, sitting back, I'm going, hey, they were spying. And I thought we knew that. I thought we knew. Now we've got validation with that 612-page report getting finally released like 3-4 years later. But right. I mean, I don't know how anyone can have confidence out of reading that.
Yeah, it actually raises so many interesting questions for me, because we have compromised our capacity as a country to understand what subversion is and espionage is and foreign interference is that what was happening in Winnipeg with these two scientists was basically normal. It had become normalized. These kinds of intimate relationships between Canadian research institutions, universities particularly, and agencies and institutions of the Chinese state were such that you could basically have a couple of people in Canada's top security microbiology and infectious diseases research institution who were violating security protocols, passing passwords around, inviting groups of foreign students to wander through the lab on the weekends and have a look at whatever they wanted. And one of them particularly was co-authoring papers with really, really dodgy characters from one of the institutions she was working with was a unit of the People's Liberation Army's microbiology division. In other words, you know, germ warfare and stuff. And the thing that is, I think, for me, that is shocking is, or the question that this raises for me is, how do these people get security clearance in the first place? You know, what kind of people are we clearing, and on what basis do we grant people the highest possible clearance to the most sensitive and dangerous top secret information in Canada? And that question we've not really got close to that question yet. The other thing to notice is that, as you say, I mean, you know, these guys were observed doing, you know, behaving in really unusual ways going back to 2018. You know, that's 6 years ago now. And, they were doing some, you know, routine security reviews. The lab brought in an outside consultant to just check the boxes and said, holy cow, who are these people that you got working for you? CSIS came in and did one review, and then it seemed to be, well, this is the way we're supposed to behave these days. And then came in a year later and did another review. And basically imagine the CSIS guy basically writing, holy crap, as he's composing this report. So I think the thing to notice is that, you know, when this started to make its way into the news media, the thing to notice is the response from the federal government, the Trudeau Liberals. You know, there's a pattern. If you are a decent, reasonable Canadian citizen and you raise concerns about the astonishing acquisition of real estate by numbered companies in China, you'll be called a racist. And in this case too, Trudeau gets up in the House of Commons. Well, you know, this is kind of racist to ask these sorts of saucy questions about what's happening in Winnipeg. And then I went to the extraordinary lengths of, actually some interesting sort of parliamentary precedent that was set of refusing a direct order from Parliament to produce documents. And it, to the point of taking the Speaker of the House of Commons to court to prevent him from ordering Public Health Canada to appear before committees and produce documents. This had never happened before. And so there is a kind of a pattern, is that anytime the issue of Chinese influence, interference, infiltration somehow enters the public consciousness, a senator or an MP in the House of Commons will raise it. It's the same thing. The Trudeau government will barricade, will block, will obfuscate, will obstruct, will filibuster. And I think, to me, this tells its own story. You know, this goes back right through the whole Chinese, and by Chinese, believe me, I'm putting that in quotation marks, interference episodes in the 2019 and 2021 elections, which we knew about, which we could watch. The Atlantic Digital Research, Forensic Research Lab was tracking this stuff. And it was only when people within the RCMP and CSIS and even within NSICOP started leaking things, you know, basically saying, holy God, this is completely out of control. The federal liberals are not paying attention to what we're telling them. They don't seem to care. That, you know, it really got traction. And so more of, you know, obstruction, we get the special rapporteur, the David Johnston thing. That completely falls apart in an absolute disgrace and catastrophe. I mean, you know, you appoint not only a lifelong family friend, a Trudeau Foundation guy, but also one of China's highest profile friends in Canada to look into this. And then you've got, you know, the majority of the House of Commons, we need a public inquiry, we need a public inquiry. And that's the stage we're at now. And we've already been given reason to believe that this inquiry is not going to do what we expected it to do. We've had the Canadian Friends of Hong Kong and the Uyghur Rights Action Project pulling out of it, saying this is wrong. We've given Yen Pao-wu, a senator who is, for all intents and purposes, the Chinese embassy's man in the Senate, and Han Dong and Michael Chan, the liberal kingmaker, who they make no apologies and don't hide their affinities with the Chinese Office of Overseas Affairs, with the United Front Work initiatives, you know, their influence peddling and strong arm units. Bigger, by the way, than the entire Chinese foreign ministry. They're a big deal. And you know, so you got Han Dong and Michael Chong that have been given standing, and also Yan Pao-wu, and that's where this thing is going. And it actually does relate to what you and I were discussing earlier about this strange eruption, these really blood-curdling eruptions of anti-Semitism in the streets, cloaked in the guise of support for the horribly suffering people of Gaza. Well, I'm not quite sure why we don't think of all that as a foreign interference operation, too. But there you go.
Let me come back to just a couple of things, because the attitude of the government clearly hasn't changed. I mean, wasn't it just last week you found the Liberal and the New Democrat MPs voting to block an ethics committee probe of why, you know, that cabinet concealed that report, you know, into the Chinese security breaches? I mean, there's been no cooperation on this file, and there's so many other examples, I know, but this just happened to show up last week. And as I say, you know what it reminds me of? There's so many different areas, and sorry, I'm digressing for a sec, but I'm looking at CISA saying that, you know, they ignored every possible security protocol to pull this off. Well, we just talked with the Auditor General about what happened with ArriveCan. And that was exactly what she said. They ignored every stated protocol of how you manage projects. You know, everywhere I look, it's this, but the efforts to block public scrutiny just can't be overlooked. You know, and that's why I don't have any faith in the so-called independent inquiry. First of all, it's taken 100 years. They're hoping I'll die and stop criticizing them, you know, before that comes true. But I'm interested to hear that you share that view, is that it's hard to have any faith that we're going to have an independent inquiry into Chinese interference.
Yeah, that's basically the gist of my piece in the National Post today. That, you know, the pattern is just so repetitive that it's almost boring now. You can just set your watch by it, that, you know, there'll be some horrible revelation that makes its way into the public debates about Chinese interference or influence or infiltration, and the government will appear to make all the right noises, and then will filibuster, obstruct, block, barricade, and that's what they've done in the latest move against the ethics committee. There wouldn't have even been a standing committee on Canada-China affairs if the Liberals had not found themselves in a minority position in Parliament 3 years ago. You know, they fought that. They said, no, you know, the Foreign Affairs Committee, that's where we deal with these things. In the case of the Ethics Committee, no, that's, you know, it's not to be dealt with at the Ethics Committee. It's not the right place for it. And then they pack committees like the House Affairs Committee, which was looking into these things fairly effectively for a while. And I think the question has to be raised. Why is the government trying to hide this? What is the government trying to hide? Why does it insist that this strangely opaque relationship that the Trudeau government, the Trudeau Liberals, the Trudeau family has maintained with through conduits like the Canada-China Business Council, the Power Corporation, the Trudeau Foundation, this strange opaque relationship with China, with the, you know, ruling elites of China and the corporate elites of China. Why aren't we allowed to look at it? Why aren't we allowed to even notice it? You know, you say something out loud about it, and the next thing you know, people are calling you a racist. And it's pretty funny, because most of the people who have been raising these issues happen to have what I like to call not suspiciously waspish sounding names. You know, they're Asians, they're Cantonese, they're Mandarin speakers as well, they're Uyghurs, they're Falun Gong practitioners, they're Chinese Democrats. You want to call them racist? Okay.
Well, and that, of course, that's the trick to shut down any conversation. We started that, by the way, if you recall, it was, I think, off the top of my head, February 4th, 2020, and talking about the possible origin of COVID from the Wuhan lab. Immediate response from Prime Minister Trudeau and Theresa Tom, Canada's health minister, was that's a racist accusation. Well, there's a lot of information that's come out since then about that potential, but I don't want to get waylaid there because I want to get into something else.
There's potential for that lab theory. I actually did dismiss it fairly out of hand at the outset. I had my own little pet theories. But I think it's not some weirdo conspiracy theory. There's reason to think that the Wuhan lab may have been involved.
Let's move on to the situation in Canada. You mentioned anti-Semitism, which, you know, anybody listening to this show knows I've been blown away by the degree. And remember, it erupted before there was any, you can't hide behind Israel's response in Gaza for that, because it was evident October 8th. You know, we had protests. We saw it in the States, and I know that's not necessarily, you know, part and parcel with Canada, but we saw it on university campuses. We saw it in public sector unions instantly, though, like before any retaliation had taken place. And I, for one, never saw that coming. I was completely blown away. And you've done some absolutely excellent work that people have to go to the National Post, go and read Terry on, and I highly recommend you subscribe to The Real Story on Substack. And by the way, we're going to give away a couple of free memberships to Substack, and I'll tell you about that in a second, to Terry's Substack, The Real Story. Literally alone in that, in digging deeper into the Selena Robinson firing by the BC cabinet, the only Jewish member, that I just think is a must read to understand what's going on. But let me just start with your broader take on, were you shocked at the anti-Semitism that we saw in public display in public institutions and other places at that degree? That's, you know, I mean, there's just no denying it was a huge degree across the country.
Well, it takes a lot to surprise me. And because I had been paying attention to this quite closely for so many years, I was actually surprised. I think I should say quite happily surprised by how shocked and surprised and disgusted so many ordinary Canadians were when they were looking at this stuff. And as you say, you know, all kinds of very, very serious and passionate criticisms can be raised in respect of the prosecution of the war in Gaza and criticisms of the Israeli government. My God, that's what Israelis do all the time. But what we saw erupt in the most blood-curdling way in Canada, the most outrageous and revolting fashion. This was happening before the blood had even dried on the ground.
Yeah.
In Kfar Azah and in the Gaza envelope and in all those other communities. I mean, I was there. I was actually there about 3 weeks ago, in the south particularly, and, you know, around in the kibbutzim. And I don't need to belabor the point, I think. It was just horrible and unspeakably sad. And this is the way we threw our arms around the innocent people of southern Israel. We went out into the streets with our placards and we started protesting at Jewish delicatessens and synagogues with Free, Free Palestine placards. Way to go.
Well,
and I think this actually is related to, you know, the incoherence that we're seeing on the subject of Chinese interference in Canada. In this way, how do you articulate national security? How do you talk about national security in a post-national state? You know, the Trudeau liberals have been, you know, the sort of borderless post-national idea of Canada, and the great advantage that we had was the Trudeau family's, you know, multi-generational relationship with the Chinese Communist Party. We got Jean Chrétien and all of these, you know, liberal gargoyles with intimate relationships with, you know, all of these state-owned enterprises, CNOC, the Chinese Investment Corporation. And we're going to, this is how we're going to build a new Canada. You know, we're going to have 100 million people living here by, what is it, 2070? I forget what the proposal is. The whole thing will be designed by Dominic Barton, you know, from the disgraced McKinsey empire, who, you know, spent half his working life, you know, greasing palms in China before he was appointed the head of Trudeau's Economic Growth Council. And then, you know, when John McCallum becomes such an embarrassment by taking China's side in the Meng Wanzhou to Michaels affair that Chrystia Freeland had to say, well, look, either he goes or I go. And so we go months without an ambassador and we get this this Dominic Barton character as our ambassador. If you don't have a sense of a core Canadian identity, if you don't have a civic nationalism with some fire in the belly that is devoted to die on this damn hill of liberal democracy, of the sanctity of our alliances with our NATO partners, the rule of law, if you don't have that, you're going to be in a difficult spot. And if you have a government that is consciously hostile to that conception of Canada, you're going to end up with spies in the Winnipeg lab. I mean, what kind of argument can you raise against it? Well, yeah, okay, well, maybe they were doing some business on the side. Maybe they had a little bit of a side hustle. Selling intellectual property to our friends in Beijing or Shanghai or Shenzhen. Yeah. And similarly, I think, too, it is a generational thing. I mean, I come by my anti-fascism, I come by it honestly. And it's a family thing. And we have some family relationships that make... I'm an Irish Catholic, and a lot of people have imagined that I'm Jewish, but I'm Irish Catholic. It's complicated. And we have family that have, you know, the Nazis, we fought the Nazis. And I think, you know, a lot of people have forgotten that there are reasons why anti-Semitism is a particularly and noticeably and historically toxic and corrosive phenomenon, and it takes all kinds of forms. My reluctant conclusion is that it is ineradicable, that it requires constant vigilance. But this is like, you talk like this to, you know, to a lot of people who have come out of the, you know, Metropolitan University of Toronto, whatever it's called now, the UBC Critical Studies, yada, yada. And they just think you're some, you know, like, what the hell are you talking about? It's just a different kind of language. And I think, in, you know, a lot of Canadians are shocked. A lot of normal Canadians have been absolutely shocked by what they've been witnessing on all of these fronts. You know, the way we normalized China, you know, relationships with the People's Republic of China, the way we've normalized the proposition that it is not beyond the pale, it is within the realm of public debate to contemplate the annihilation of the state of Israel, the fruits of the Jewish national liberation movement can be sundered and the Jews can be driven into the sea. And this is, well, this is an interesting opinion.
Yeah.
You know, we'll go to you, you know, what do you think of this? It's like, no. At some point, you just got to say, you know, those are fighting words.
What worries me is that, yeah, I wonder what that line is for many people. But just to add to what you're saying, because your work has done great work in this, the level of infiltration is shocking of the Chinese Communist Party of Canada. You mentioned the United Workers Front Department. I mean, my God, we know that's the Communist Party of China. It's not like it's, oh, that's a shock. They're operating freely in our country. They were operating freely, these secret police stations. That's on one level. Let's go to the, as you say, the relationship. I think it's the degree to which the anti-Semitism is in our political parties. I mean, clearly in the NDP, clearly in the Liberal Party of Canada, that it's in clearly at our universities, clearly at our public sector workers. And there was no bottom line, you know, something that would have been so abhorrent to us. I don't know. You probably know a better time frame than I would. But, you know, I just don't think it was happening 15 years ago. You know, I mean, a smaller degree. It's the degree to which I think that has shocked many people, even those who were paying attention. It's the degree to it.
Yeah, my friend Ben Cohen has written a wonderful book about this. He's a Londoner. I love Ben. It's called Some of My Best Friends, .. And he makes a distinction between what he calls beer keller anti-Semitism and bistro anti-Semitism. You know, we're used to the sort of beer keller anti-Semitism. You know, it's usually, you know, really awful, nasty people. Some of them are at the extreme fringes of the of various conservative parties. You know, skinheads, whatever. We can see it. We can recognize it. You know, it's easily recognizable. What's far more insidious and what people haven't been paying attention to is what Ben calls bistro anti-Semitism. And it's the anti-Semitism of the radical chic, of the avant-garde. And it is very much a thing, and it is perhaps even more destructive because it's a function like, you know, fascism and Nazism used to be a function of what... back when we were Marxists, we would call the petty bourgeoisie. But bistro anti-Semitism is really a function of the elites and elite, you know, university graduates and people who run art galleries. And it's not the kind of thing that we're that a lot of, shall I say, Gentiles are used to. And it's extremely toxic and extremely corrosive. So yeah, I think we're at a very interesting inflection moment in Western history and in Canadian history. And I think we really do need to, you know, I actually do have some opinions about this. I don't just make, you know, write backgrounders and analyses. This for me is this is the line you don't goddamn well cross. You know, I mean, like I, you know, I've got a mezuzah hanging from my door. You know, nobody, when push comes to shove, I'm sorry, it's just a line you can't cross. And I think a lot of people in the NDP, a lot of people cross it without knowing it even. You know, it's sort of like the illiterate left. A lot of people go to these demonstrations because they're upset and they don't know anybody, you know, and that's what Canadians do. You know, you're mad about something you've seen on the TV, you know, you got some friends and they're, we're going to go to a demonstration and stop the war. Okay. I mean, bless their hearts, right? But I'm afraid most of these demonstrations, actually, most of them have been organized by, well, in on the West Coast, you know, you've got Samadoun, which is the overseas fundraising and recruitment arm of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which is a Palestinian terrorist group best known for airline hijackings and suicide bombings and that kind of thing. And you've got the Palestine Youth Movement, which was handing out sweets by the evening of October 7th, Michael, rejoicing in this stuff. And it's here. It's here. It's among us now. And unless we develop, as I say, some kind of liberal democratic fire in the belly, in the way of a civic nationalism that can guard against these toxicities, these pathogens, these sociopathologies, then we're in trouble. We're in big trouble.
I
And a
think
lot of it's, you know, it's it comes down to, you know, a significant sort of identifying factor, and it infects journalism. You know, if there's no such thing as truth, if you can't, if the disciplines of journalism that allowed reporters to do a fairly good job of arriving at the truth, approaching the truth, if this is all sort of problematized to the point where it's your truth and it's my truth and it's somebody else's truth, then ultimately the truth that will prevail will be the truth with the deepest pockets, the loudest voices, the shiniest boots, and the sharpest knives. So, you know, we better get ready for this.
Well, I just think that's very well put, and it's again why I just think people should go to the National Post. You know, type in Terry, you can read just about anything, but his work on these two subjects has been brilliant. But also, we're going to give away, you know, some subscriptions to The Real Story. You can get it on Substack. And the extra depth that Terry gets a chance to go into on these very important subjects, though. Very, I mean, I just am very thankful for that level of industriousness and intellectual rigor that Terry presents on a absolutely regular basis.
Well, that's
Absolutely.
really kind of you.
Well,
Really
it's
kind.
absolutely true. And I think people listening to this show know I call it as I see it, and that's how I see it. Terry, thank you for finding time for us. As always, it's so much appreciated.
As always, it's always lovely to talk to you.
Thank you.
Take care, Mike.
Just a reminder, we're giving away two subscriptions to Terry's The Real Story, Terry Glavin's The Real Story on Substack. It is absolutely excellent. I have paid for my subscription. I subscribe there, The Real Story. So, two, all you have to do is we're going to make a draw out of people who belong with 5 Minutes with Mike, if you're one of the subscribers there. And it's absolutely free, 5 Minutes with Mike. And if you want to be a subscriber, well, simply go to mikesmoneytalks.ca and sign up. You'll be part of that draw. You could win one of the two subscriptions available for The Real Story. Time now for the quote of the week. Let me give you a little context here. Canada's federal debt grows at the rate of around $4.5 million per hour. It's about 110 million per day. And as of today, Saturday, March 9th, it's estimated to be our whole federal, total federal debt, not provincial, municipal, crown corporations, just the federal debt, $1,218,420,000,000. Well, this week, the Parliamentary Budget Office warned that on this year's deficit, the interest costs alone are going to be about $7 billion more than recently forecast. Specifically, the PBO forecasts that interest costs on the federal debt are going to be about $47 billion versus the forecast of around $40 billion. But interest costs are still going to rise from here to around $52 billion next year, 2024-25, and about $53 billion 2025-26. Now, escalating debt is an issue for a minority of Canadians, while the majority have other priorities. But you know what? Regardless where you put the rising government debt and deficits and the interest cost on theirs on your list of concerns, there are definite consequences. Government financial choices are limited. The continued debt is inflationary, while eroding the purchasing power of the currency, which does top the list of concerns. Now, that's the backdrop for this week's quote of the week. And for it, I'm going to go back over 600 years to Alexander Tytler. He was a Scottish judge, a writer, historian. He was professor of universal history and of Greek and Roman antiquities at the University of Edinburgh. In quotes, "A democracy will continue to exist until the time that voters discover they can vote themselves generous gifts from the public treasury. From that moment on, the majority always votes for the candidates who promise the most benefits from the public treasury, with the result that every democracy will finally collapse due to loose fiscal policy." P.S. You don't think so? You know what? That's already happening in dozens of third world countries who've got their currencies collapsing and inflation at double digits. So don't say you weren't warned. I want to turn around and talk about the markets at this point. I mean, who hasn't seen the huge increases that we're flirting with these all-time highs? Our individual stocks are skyrocketing. I was looking, actually, even the Russell 2000 has kind of made a nice little quiet move. Everything is quiet, I guess, compared to NVIDIA. But the point is, there's things you should do within that. So I asked Neil McIver to join me, McIver Capital Management. Neil's been in the business for a huge number of years, a successful portfolio manager. He has his own model portfolio that's done extremely well. Neil, let me just start with that. You know, you get a move like this in stocks, it really requires us not to fall asleep, but to pay attention. I mean, maybe I'm overexposed in some areas now.
Well, this is common, Michael. I mean, absolutely dead common. And people often leave portfolios that have outperformed in one area or another, you know, with that outperformance inside of the portfolio. So something you might have wanted to, that should be 20% of your portfolio, was now 40% of your portfolio. Yeah. And one of the great mistakes is just simply to leave it. But you've actually unbalanced your portfolio tremendously by doing that, because you're probably taking too much risk and you're probably in an asset class that's going to normalize again and move back. But, you know, Michael, it all starts with having a strategic asset allocation in the very first place. And portfolio management is really a process. And individuals often lament that institutions do far better than individuals do. And they think that this is an informational thing. And it's not. It's really just about discipline. And the first thing it starts off with is creating a strategic asset allocation. And you can go online. There's various resources there. You can look at portfolio strategic asset allocation, portfolio optimizer. And there's those. You can go to our website, mckivercapitalmanagement.com. Talk to our people on there. My team can help you out by creating one. But what is one? Well, really, a strategic asset allocation is the blueprint for your portfolio. It's a strategic asset mix of various asset classes and market sectors that match what your particular risk tolerance is. And it's going to tell you, you know, what percentage of, say, U.S. large cap growth stocks you should have in your portfolio. That's obviously a popular one right now. Or U.S. mid cap value. You mentioned the Russell 2000, Canadian equities, bonds, high yield positions, how much cash, all of those different things. And these strategic asset allocations have all been back tested, and they're so accurate they can actually project forward what your overall return should be. All institutions use these models when they build portfolios. They know exactly how much risk they're taking in the first place. Now, the key is that you got to stick to that strategic asset allocation. And this is what we were just talking about with part of your portfolio going off the rails a little bit. So, and it might be off the rails in a positive way. It might have gone up very, very nicely, or it may have fallen. But at regular intervals, and most of the studies suggest about once a year, a portfolio needs to be rebalanced back to its strategic asset mix. So imagine that, you know, part of your portfolio, let's say the S&P 500 large cap growth sector, the one that's very popular right now, its long-term normalized rate of return is about 10%. And then let's say it gives you 20% a year for 3 years. Okay, so its normalized rate of return is just 10. It's giving you 20 for 3 years in a row. That extra 30% is going to leave you. It's going to go out the window at some point in time. That's just a guarantee. Look back at 2022. We had a couple of great years, and then the market all came down significantly. And this normalization, it's a natural movement in the market. Everything that outperforms at some point in time gives back those excess returns, and everything that underperforms for a period of time will make up those returns. So it's a process of using that to your advantage. And the rebalance is critical because it takes advantage of this normalization by selling the portions of the portfolio that have outperformed and then buying the parts that have underperformed inside of a portfolio.
You know, Neil, what I like about that is that we're always talking about risk management, as you are as a professional. So you give them a blueprint to be a risk manager that takes sort of the momentary decision out. You already, as you said, you already worked with your professional. You know where you should be. But the thing that I think is a little easier about this now is we've just seen all of this in action. I mean, it's totally validated historically, but you don't have to have much of a memory other than the last couple of years, as you alluded to. You know, something that went up, oh, wow, they went down, but stuff that went down, oh, they went up. So this is what protects you in those kind of a market environment. So I just think, you know, that's something that people can wrap their heads around and with real life experience. But I also, just while I think of it, I want to make sure people understand that you've got a webinar coming up on Tuesday, March 12th, right? It's 11 a.m. Pacific daylight time, but you're going to be talking about this kind of thing. I mean, what Bay Street and Wall Street really don't encourage you to know, then that's why you need a professional. But let me throw a couple of other things out there at you, because I know you've written some things on this. And it seems like you were prescient at the time, but boy, has that ever been validated, as you had a lot of questions about the ESG agenda as an, not as a, we're not talking about the philosophy or climate or anything like that. We're talking about as an investment driver. And I want you to elaborate a little bit more, because as I say, what you've been saying in the past has certainly been validated.
Well, absolutely. I've been talking about it for a number of years. And let me tell you a story. This happened about 4 or 5 years ago. And a somewhat younger but very experienced investment advisor took me for coffee to tell me about this big marketing push that he was going to be doing and how he was going to grow his business. And, you know, sort of as an elder statesman in the business, I'm always happy to help if I can provide a little bit of experience there. And what he told me is that he was going to become an all ESG, or equity, social, and governance advisor. And he was going to become an expert in this particular field and only invest in whatever he considered to be ESG. Now, there's lots of different filters. That's a different issue that we could talk about for a long time. But he wanted to know what my thoughts on this, and I'm sure he wanted to be validated in terms of the direction that he was going to go. However, I have a tendency to be, you know, fairly brutally honest, and I told him I thought it was a terrible idea. I said right up front, you're not going to get my money, because you're telling me, the potential client in this made up environment, that you have an agenda with my money. And I wish an advisor who is unashamedly an advocate for my future wealth and prosperity. I don't wish an advisor to use my capital for their agenda, regardless of the altruistic goals of that agenda. And I said, I think you're wrong. But there's also another issue that is very, very prescient and important here. And that's positive correlation. So when you build a portfolio, this is very dangerous, and you use these ESG filters, the net result of selecting stocks is that through these filters is there's going to be a relatively high degree of commonality with all of those individual positions. So they're going to be positively correlated, meaning they're going to go up or down based upon the same economic input, which actually you do not ever wish, because that lowers the long-term rate of return and increases the volatility inside of the portfolio. Well, you know, he didn't listen to me. So a couple of years later, we roll into 2022. High interest rates rise dramatically. They murder high speculation and high tech stock. You know, basically where most of these ESG stocks are the ones that come through these filters live. And most of these stocks fell by 50%, some of them as high as much as 70%. Look at Cathie Wood's ARK ETF. It lost some 70%. Well, unfortunately for this gentleman, he's no longer in the investment business, because his clients also lost 70% of their investments. So, you know, I just encourage folks that you've got a choice in this. You can choose how your money is invested, but you've got to do some research and ask some questions. I think that's absolutely critical.
I wish you had added there, Neil, I wish you had added and listened to Money Talks. Just kidding.
Yes.
But your point is very well taken, Neil, that, you know, it doesn't take a lot, but be interested and ask those questions. Don't be intimidated. But what I'm hearing from you is you got to drive your own investment bus, if you know what I mean, with expertise, with people saying, here's a roadmap, here's a destination, et cetera. But be engaged in that way, because that point is very well taken. We now have, as you said, you've been saying that for about 5-6 years. But we've got quantification of that past your individual anecdotal experience. We've seen that abandoned. But it's, the bigger point being, you know, there should be one agenda with your money, and that is, how are you doing? Risk management, yeah. Rewards. That's what counts, not what your advisor or your mutual fund manager's got as a goal, if you know what I mean. The goal should be you.
The goal should be you. And I call it virtue investing. And you might feel good about your investing, but it's not necessarily moving you towards what your final goal is. Now, something I wanted to bring up was an organization called Climate Action 100 Plus. And this is an organization that's got both asset managers, people like me, but much larger than we are, and issuers, meaning corporations out there. And the goal of this group is to force companies effectively to decarbonize, which is in effect to deindustrialize much of the West. And that is the actual stated goal of Climate Action 100 Plus. So it's designed to basically leverage the power of the investors, people like BlackRock that jumped into this a few years ago, and these huge investors, to force corporate action change at these corporations. Companies, by the way, like Exxon, companies like Suncor, and they're supposed to be effectively accepting what these investment managers are saying. Now, just to fast forward to today, there's been a big ESG exit over the last little while. So there's been some common sense that has been infused or has expressed itself in this space. And giant BlackRock recently pulled out of this Climate Action 100 group, this dangerous group, with CEO Larry Fink stating that he doesn't even want to use the word ESG anymore, and that he was, I think, ashamed or embarrassed. I don't remember what the term was. That was followed by JP Morgan. That was followed by bond giant PIMCO. That was followed by Invesco and State Street. Berkshire Hathaway had some comments on that. So did Vanguard as well, too. They weren't part of it, but they did encourage, and they were on the side of these companies leaving. And this is all because of the citing's basic disconnect and legal problems related to their fiduciary relationship to the client, meaning that they don't wish to get sued for not always doing the best thing for their client because they have this alternative agenda with the capital. But you know, folks, you've got to vote, and you don't have to be trapped by virtue investing. You can do what you wish with your money. But let's have a quick look here at who's still left in Climate Action 100 Plus. Now, remember, the big guys have all left. Literally eye-watering billions of dollars have left this whole area. But who's still in there? BMO Global Asset Managers, Desjardins Global Asset Managers, Fidelity Investments Canada, IG Wealth Investment, Mackenzie Investments, Manulife, NEI Investments, RBC Global Asset Management, TD Asset Management, University of Toronto Asset Management. Well, that's not really a surprise. University of Laval, a whole series of other ones. Do those sound familiar to you?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
So, you know, that's where that's where your dollars are going. And that's where you've got to vote here. And you don't necessarily have to give them your money. And, you know, take a look forward. You know, Exxon is now suing sustainable investment firms. And their quote from their CEO, where is it here? Is that it would be forcing Exxon to change the very nature of its ordinary business or go entirely out of business, which is just insane. Why would they want to be a part of this organization? Why would they accept the pressure from companies like BlackRock? I just see a lot of this as being rolled back, and there's some common sense that's now coming into the marketplace. And once again, hopefully, these organizations are going to make the client the center, and these people just need to be the greatest advocate possible for the client's sustainable wealth into the future.
Well, as I say, part of that agenda is to pay attention, as you're saying. You know, it's been shifting. And that's why, you know, it's great that you're going to do this webinar. What Bay Street and Wall Street don't want you to know, and that's Tuesday, March 12th, It's 11 a.m. Pacific Daylight Time. Note that, Daylight Time. Neil will be there. Neil, that sounds terrific. And all people have to do, by the way, and we'll put up all the information, just go to mikesmoneytalks.ca. We'll put all the information up, mikesmoneytalks.ca. And this is a kind of reminder and the kind of information that I think forms the foundation of people's management of their money. You know, everything we can do to become better informed, more sophisticated, great opportunity here to take advantage of that. So as I say, go to mikesmoneytalks.ca and join Neil and his team at McIver Capital Management. Neil, as always, we very much appreciate you finding time for us.
It was my pleasure and my honor, Mike.
Well, we had both the Federal Reserve and we had the Bank of Canada chiming in on interest rates. Of course, in the Bank of Canada's case, what is it, the fifth consecutive meeting that they've held rates steady? I'm going to grab Michael Levy for this right now. Mike, you know, you'll have to forgive me, but when I heard both Jerome Powell, Federal Reserve Chairman, and Tiff Macklin, Governor of the Bank of Canada, I could have just interchanged the two of them. I mean, I just, that's what jumped out at me, is that, are they reading the same script here?
You know, it's like standing up in a place of worship and everybody gets a hymn book and they're all singing from the same hymn book.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's just the way it is. The Wall Street Journal talking about Jerome Powell and what he had to say. He says, brisk inflation, hiring data in January haven't altered the Federal Reserve's expectation that it will be appropriate to cut interest rates later this year. And then we go on to the Globe and Mail, and now we're looking at our governor, and what does Tiff Macklem have to say? With a rate of inflation inching closer to the bank's 2% target, and the Canadian economy stagnating under the weight of high borrowing costs, central bank officials don't expect to raise rates any further. In fact, though, we're not taking them down either. Well, Mike, those two, and they fit, and really they are interchangeable reading both columns. But then I open the Wall Street Journal, and here's the European Central Bank. I guess they got Powell's note too, because they're singing exactly from the same songbook. So I don't believe in conspiracy theories, but I really believe the Bank of Canada and the U.S. Federal Reserve might be talking at some level, and I wouldn't be surprised if the central bank governors, including the ECB, are taking a coordinated approach.
Yeah, I think absolutely that's the case. They've been doing it right, you know, probably do it forever, but, you know, the pandemic certainly brought occasion for that, and it continues today. Mike, just a couple of things. So around that, I think noteworthy, just to emphasize what you said, they all sort of agreed that the increases were over. It's just, when do they have the decreases, you know, jumping in, you know, at this point? So I think that's an important point just to highlight for people. But again, it's going to disappoint. The only thing I want to throw at you with this is that it's interesting to note the Parliamentary Budget Office also came out with a report, you know, this week, and they're suggesting, they still say that they think that the first rate cut in Canada could come in April, and we'll be down about 1.5% by the end of the year.
Well, you know, that was then, this is now almost, and that's almost like on a daily basis, Mike. But right now, the vibes I'm hearing from all three, the Bank of Canada, the U.S. Fed, the ECB, June might be the first, and they're changing their tune, all three of them at the same time. Don't look for a lot more rate cuts this year, where, Mike, a month ago, they were looking for 3 or 4 rate cuts from April to the end of the year. You and I were talking about that, and they're just pushing back right now.
But the other thing, very quickly, to note that the U.S. economy is in much better shape than the Canadian economy. I mean, we're not, you know, we can throw terms around, is it robust or not? No, but the bottom line is it's stronger than Canada. So their rate scenario should be different. But as you say, right at the top, it looks like they're all talking the same thing.
I'm going to go one step further. Their economy is robust, specifically compared to ours. Ours is down in the doldrums. We are not going anywhere. The growth is not there. It's stagnating. So I think there's a big difference between the U.S. and Canada. I don't know where I'd put Europe right now, because it's so many countries piled into one in the ECB. But I think the U.S. and Canada are different. And I think it's going to be, in my opinion, the U.S. is going to go first, or they'll go at the same time.
Well, just a measure of people's concerns over cost of living, over what, 45% of Canadian mortgages are going to be renewed this year and next year. You know, it's a big subject that we have to keep our eye on. And of course, that's what you're doing on a regular basis, Mike.
Yeah, and I'm going to say, Mike, is that we are going to have to look at it closely, but I believe the banks are going to be steadfast in not taking rates down unless inflation comes down, and it's not going to do that in Canada with interest rates at this level and people having to put up so much money for shelter. That is not good for inflation.
Do not start me on policy-induced inflation. We'll be here all day. Obviously, the Bank of Canada's rate decisions are playing a large part in people's cost of living. Mike, have a great week.
You too, Mike.
Well, we got the latest numbers on real estate. Plus, we're getting into that spring market feeling. I know some places in this country do not feel like spring, but I want to bring Ozzy Jurek in right now. You can find him at ozbuzz.ca. Ozzy, I won't go further with this other than say congratulations. You bring so many people involved in the polar plunge, and I'll just let everybody know, this guy went in with a smile on his face while yours truly is sitting there wiping the tears from his eyes at the prospect of the cold water. So congratulations to Ozzy, to you, and everyone else who participated. So much appreciated. Ozzy, I want to just get to the numbers right now. Just give us a sense of the state of the market in real estate.
Well, the news will be right across the country that sales are up, you know, prices are up, everything is wonderful. But when you look into the numbers, it's not as wonderful. We're certainly better up. Toronto sales are up about 17%. But when you consider that it was a leap year, then sales are up only 13%. Prices are up 0.2% over 2023. Yoo-hoo! But when you take a look at the high for a single family home in Toronto in March 2022, 2 years ago, was $1.9 million. Now it's $1.6 million. So it's up 0.2% over last year, but it's still way below where it was. And that's sort of the story everywhere. New listings in Toronto are up 33%. In Vancouver, new listings in the Fraser Valley are up 56% for single family and 39% for condo. So there's more product available going into the spring. If you look at Calgary, sales are up 23%. Listings under 500,000 are down 40%. Prices for condos up almost 20% and single family prices are up 13%. So across the board, it looks somewhat better. But if you look at Vancouver, Mike, in February 2024, our sales were 565. Last year, they were 516. 9% increase. Yoo-hoo, time to celebrate. But in 2022, we sold 1,010, and in 2021, we sold 1,240. That's 50%. So we're still 28% below the 10-year average, and we are way below where we were.
And of course, the February, when you're going up February 22, that's just before we began the interest rates increases that, of course, were relentless at that point. Let me just a quick question on those numbers, though, because we're entering the spring market here. And that traditionally has been a more positive time. It was last year, you know, in March, April, you know, May kind of thing. What are you hearing on the ground right now? Are people in that industry busier or, you know, what are you looking at here?
That's a good point because the Bank of Canada left the rate as the same. That means that variable rates will remain unchanged the way they were always, at least until April the 10th. The fixed rates might begin to drop in the next couple of weeks if the bond rates continue down. So we're getting reports that lawyers are getting really busy. Lenders are beginning to backlog. So certainly if you're buying a property, make sure that you've got your ducks in a row and your tenant information and your own bank information that it's all up to date because lawyers are going to get mad at you if you say, but you want to do what? You want to close that in a week? It's not possible. So the spring market is here. And the March numbers will tell the story for the year.
One other thing that you've brought to our attention over the years is that it's one thing to post a rate. It's another thing to qualify for it. You know, they don't have to lend us money. There's nothing behind, you know, any legislation that says if someone, in fact, sort of meets the qualifications, you must lend to them. So do you think that'll still be a problem? Because we're seeing an inch up, at least in mortgage defaults, you know. So do you think that's going to be a problem is, hey, I qualify, but tough luck. We're not lending you the money at that rate.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, even at the large deals, one of the biggest developers recently at a meeting said he used to get a $60 million loan on a high rise from one bank. Now it needs six banks to get together and create a consortium to do the lending. So they're much tougher lending also for the individuals. Mm-hmm. But in general, there is competition for the good credit risk. That's why we talked the last few weeks about the so-called whisper mortgage.
Okay, I want to finish with something here, Ozzy, and it's an example. You know, it's one of my themes is, you know, politicians talk about affordability, and everywhere I turn, they make it more difficult. Well, let's go out to, it's a suburb of Victoria, or just outside of Victoria, Langford. I've been reading a horror story and been told by people directly, a horror story about what they're facing when it comes to property tax increases.
Yeah, I was talking to Rick Hogendorn, who was a very quality developer in Victoria, and he says, unbelievably, the city increased its property taxes by 15.6%. And that's not just it. I mean, last year they increased by 12%. So over 2 years, it's now 27.5%. And then the Langford had an amenity fund, which was actually paid for by developers and intended for public projects like parks and so on. But they're now no longer offsetting those increases as well. So it is a serious increase in taxes.
Well, I mean, gosh, and especially the right thing is to look, and it's the same with any cost of living thing. Let's look over the last few years. You're saying in the last 2 years, 27%, not doable. Again, that's an absolute head shaker when we talk about that. As I say, I got nothing more to add to it. I just want to bring people's attention. Ozzy, but you've got much more to add if people go to ozbuzz.ca. And again, you got to put in your address because they don't know where to send it otherwise. Send your email address in there and you'll qualify. He does it once a week. Great stuff. Bring you up to date. A chance to get the numbers in person, get more updates from Ozzy Jurek. Ozzy, in the meantime, I hope you have a terrific week.
Thanks, Mike. And just remember, you know, that Irma Bombach, she said, when your children are unruly, I use a nice, safe playpen. And when they're finished, I climb out.
Ozzy Jurek, ozbuzz.ca. I'm going to go live to the trading desk now. I've got Victor Adair with me, and you can find Victor at victoradair.ca. Hey, Vic, I was thinking again, when I'm looking at the price action of NVIDIA, price action of gold, price action of my old favorites, those NFT, non-fungible tokens. You know, when I do, I laugh when I think about those. But it's back to what you were saying, and you've been consistent on this. Welcome to the casino world. You know, it just feels that way still.
Yeah, the more speculative end of the market just got wilder this week, I think. And for instance, in the crypto space, Bitcoin made a new all-time high this week, above $70,000. That's up 55% from, well, not yesterday, but the February
it
lows.
Feels like it.
Yeah, and it's up 3.5x from where it was a year ago. You know, I mean, the Bitcoin is smoking hot. Gold has hit all-time highs, although compared to Bitcoin, I mean, gold is dull. The speculative end of the stock market, certainly the S&P here and the NASDAQ made new all-time highs this week. The Dow didn't. The Toronto market was at 23-month highs, made a new high. But it really feels like here, when you look at some of the individual issues, and you mentioned NVIDIA, it is just wicked. I think the price range on Friday between the high and the low in that stock alone was several hundred billion dollars. I mean, it's just wild out there.
Yeah. A couple of sides of the question. One, you as a trader are still just watching market action, you know, there and making whether you think the market's up, down, or it's a flat, whatever it is. But it's just even on the bigger picture, what do we make of this? Because it feels like we've done this about three times now in the last few years. We may have had a couple of different names attached to it. I always get this wrong, but was it the meme stocks, you know, when we had AMC and BlackBerry and all of those, you know, I'm forgetting some of them because I didn't play in them because I don't like parabolic. I don't mind owning a parabolic stock, but I'm going to get out way too soon.
Yeah, I don't think it's as unhinged, say, as it was in 2021, you know, when everybody was trading at home in their pajamas and so on and jumping into the meme stocks and that sort of thing. But, okay, and this is my opinion. This is, I don't know, and I'm certainly not giving investment advice, but you asked me, so I'll say it this way. I think what I would call fundamental long-term money, which considers valuations, is probably doing some selling here. You're thinking this is okay, sold to you. I think the buying here is more from short-term technical, momentum-driven, FOMO-driven, and certainly heavily, retail. as opposed to, you know, the pension funds aren't leaping in here in size.
Okay, well, let me put you on the spot for a second, and forgive me, I'll bring it down personally, and just ask you, what's sort of the best trade you've put on in the last little bit?
I'd say this year the best trade I've had, and I hope I don't put the mouth on it, as our friend Greg used to say, but I bought the Japanese yen right, what turned out to be right at the lows last month. My thought was, first of all, it was at 34-year lows. I saw there was a massive speculative short position in against the yen, where and there's folks that are playing in this market that are huge, they're very aggressive and so on, but people were had these massive short positions. I'm assuming they were betting that the Bank of Japan or the authorities over there would not try to intervene to keep the yen from going lower. But and that, I mean, that's an ideal for me, you know, when there's a whole bunch of people leaning one way, I could say, well, if they're wrong, you know, so I think right now some of those folks are starting to cover. It looks like we may have the Bank of Japan raise interest rates later this month for the first time since, I think it's 2007. Their wage growth is picking up. Even the prime minister is encouraging people to pay their employees more. So they're trying to get some inflation going. So anyway, yes, that's been my best trade so far this year.
Well, just to remind listeners, Vic, you might remember that when Vic and I were talking about it on the air, I called it our travelog show, because if you're ever considering going to Japan, you know, we would have, as you just said, Vic, you showed us the low in that Japanese yen, you know, so make our take advantage of that, you know, for travel, you know. So I'm just reminding people, we were talking about that, and you might remember it by me calling it the travelog show. Exactly. Yeah. Okay, let me come back to just a couple more things as we've got here and get into the market bond reaction to what we've seen. I talked earlier with Michael about the Federal Reserve and Bank of Canada. Talk maybe a minute just quickly about the Canadian dollar.
Well, Canadian dollar, I think this week got up to about a one-month high. We traded up to, I think, about where were we? 74.5 cents or something like that.
Exactly.
Canada, you know, I pay a lot of attention to correlations, okay? And the Canadian dollar is much more affected by things that happen. When we say the Canadian dollar, that's Canada against the U.S. dollar. The value of the Canadian dollar is much more affected usually by things that happen outside of Canada, not inside, okay? So the tone here for the past maybe a month or so, the U.S. dollar has been a little bit softer, and the stock market has been rising. So in that kind of an environment, the Canadian dollar tends to get bid up a little bit. On Friday morning, the employment data we had here in Canada, a little stronger than the market expected, but the market kind of failed to make new highs. So from a trading perspective, I'm happy to sell, be short the Canada here relative to the U.S. and I'm just looking at all those correlations between Canada, the stock market, and Canada and other currencies and so on.
Well, that's great stuff as usual. And I invite people to go to victoradair.ca, victoradair.ca. I love the visuals, Vic, so keep them coming. People can go there absolutely free, victoradair.ca. Vic, go out and have a terrific week.
Thanks, Mike.
Time now for this week's Goofy Award. The United Nations Relief and Work Agency, called UNRWA, was formed in 1949 and has now grown to over 30,000 employees, has a budget of over $1.6 billion per year. But half of that budget goes to finance schools in Gaza, which are accused of promoting hatred of Jews and Israel, and as such have become incubators for future Hamas terrorist recruits. According to the textbooks used in UNRWA schools, Jews have no rights whatsoever or legitimate status in Israel. A Jewish presence in the country is denied historically, geographically, and religiously. In addition, there's well-documented evidence that UNRWA has allowed its school buildings to be used by Hamas as storehouses for rockets and weapons. And along with hospitals, they've allowed the construction of tunnels used to shelter jihadi terrorists, which, by the way, is a war crime under the Fourth Geneva Convention. For years, UNRWA, though, has been accused of working closely with Hamas. But accusations that it openly supported the October 7th massacre and had 3,000 UNRWA teachers celebrating the slaughter, well, it's brought on renewed focus. But as Hillel Neuer, United Nations Watch, stated before a congressional committee, How could anyone possibly be shocked that UNRWA employees are implicated in terrorism? He said, we sent them reports in 2021, 2019, 17, and 15, and no one at the UN even replied. And not surprisingly, the accusations that 12 UNRWA workers participated directly in the October 7th attack and that 1,200 are affiliated with members or Hamas or Islamic Jihad, well, of course, that's brought condemnation across the Western world. Well, the evidence was sufficient for 12 Western nations, including Canada, to suspend future funding to UNRWA. But this week, new evidence also arrived linking two other UNRWA workers directly to the October 7th attack. We got the Israeli army stating that at least 450 UNRWA employees are military operatives in terror groups in Gaza. And that brings me to the Goofy Award. While Canada did promise to suspend funding for UNRWA in January, it has now stated it's going to do it again. It's going to reinstate $25 million in funding in April. But you know, the point is, it didn't miss a beat. It wasn't due to make any funding, so it announces it in January. Well, they weren't supposed to send any money for February and March, so they're back on it for April. So in fact, no funding was missed. You know, it's interesting, though, when they first made this announcement, there was such a blowback or suggestions of the announcement. They actually called a press conference and then canceled it. The suggestion, though, that this is what about to be happened brought immediate condemnation, huge blowback, including from Liberal MPs Anthony Housefather and Marco Mendicino, who favor instead establishing a new vehicle for humanitarian aid in Gaza. At first, the prime minister was noncommittal, but now they've reconfirmed. But they've been facing political pressure on both sides. I mean, think about it. You know, the Toronto Sun's Brian Lilly reports that the National Council of Canadian Muslims, along with 300 Muslim organizations, threaten political consequences if their demands are not met. And one of those demands, immediate resumption of funding for UNRWA. While opponents, including any taxpayer who doesn't want to see their hard-earned money go to an organization, or such a questionable organization, but one who's been accused of abetting and aiding a terrorist organization responsible for rape, slaughter of civilians, really for the crime of only being Jewish. Well, you've got people who don't want to see their tax dollars going there. I mean, that's the split that we're seeing right now. And I know which side I'm on, but I can't speak for you. Hey, that's all the time we have this week. A reminder, you can grab that Terry Glavin interview on YouTube as we publish our featured interview every week on YouTube. So go ahead, check it out, Terry Glavin on YouTube. Also, of course, I really invite you to check out mikesmoneytalks.ca. Also, go to our Twitter feed, or I should say X, pardon me, Michael Campbell. We can find it, Money Talks Tweets on Twitter, but we go to Facebook, and it's Michael Campbell's Money Talks on Facebook. But you know what I'm really trying to say? I think you'll get a lot of great information there that will enhance your understanding of what's going on. You make your decisions, but we really appreciate you taking time and the support you give by listening to Money Talks.